Our first reading this morning is from the second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 4, and we will commence at verse 3. For if the gospel we preach is hidden, it is hidden only from those who are being lost. They do not believe, because their minds have been kept in the dark by the evil God of this world. He keeps them from seeing the light shining on them, the light that comes from the good news about the glory of Christ, who is the exact likeness of God. For it is not ourselves that we preach. We preach Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. The God who said, "Out of darkness the light shall shine," is the same God who made his life shine in our hearts to bring us the knowledge of God's glory shining in the face of Christ. The gospel reading is from Mark chapter 9, and we will commence at verse 2. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, and led them up a high mountain where they were alone. As they looked on, a change came over Jesus, and his clothes became shining white, whiter than anyone in the world could wash them. Then the three disciples saw Elijah and Moses talking with Jesus. Peter spoke up and said to Jesus, "Teacher, how good it is that we are here. We will make three tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He and the others were so frightened that he did not know what to say. Then a cloud appeared and covered them with its shadow, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is my own dear son. Listen to him." They took a quick look round, but did not see anyone else. Only Jesus was with them. As they came down the mountain, Jesus ordered them, "Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has risen from death." This is the word of the Lord.
In the reading from Corinthians, we heard those interesting words, I suppose, that talks about the gospel being hidden, perhaps from some, by the evil God of this world. So that's a bit of an odd phrase that you might not hear spoken of very often. But one of the questions becomes, well, what is that, or who is that? Now, some of you here have got a year or two on me. Others a little bit closer to my age, but certainly at the time when I was a teenager and a young adult, there was lots of talk going on about, you know, the mark of the beast and 666 and all that. Have you heard that kind of conversation? Seen plenty of nods around the place. So the question always becomes, well, what is that? Who is that? And we often talk about, God, and then we talk about the devil or Satan or old Nick or whatever name you want to give to what we might call the opposite of God. And certainly Jesus talks about there being a devil as well. So that's something that's there. But the other thing is that when we think about some of the number kind of images that we have in the Bible, it would seem particularly through the Old Testament, that the idea of seven being connected with God is fairly strong. And so we think of, you know, God's perfect number, if you like, as seven. It's got nothing to do with lucky numbers elsewhere, right? Nothing to do with that whatsoever. But God's number, they often talk about as being seven. So then we have this idea of, well, what is six, or 666, if you like? And while some people are quick to attribute that to perhaps a demonic kind of force, one of the other ways of thinking about that, and it's probably something that I lean towards to some degree, is the idea that perhaps this is the best that humanity can be without God. You got that? Perhaps the best that we can be without God. Because there are lots of times when we try to take God's place, when we want to stop listening to God's direction, when we want to ignore the leading of the Spirit, when we don't want to think particularly about the scriptures or whatever, we decide that we know better. And if you're trying to work out, well, where does this odd idea come from, if you haven't heard it before, then it goes right back to the second creation story in the garden, where we have these images or people that are talked about of Adam and Eve, where they decide that they can be as wise or wiser than God and make their own decisions. Do you remember that story? Might be worth having a look at again at some stage. Because when the fruit is offered to the people in the garden, the temptation is that if they eat it, they will become wise and they will become like God. So for me, this idea about who is the one that blocks us from recognizing God around us or hearing God speak, when Paul writes to the people in Corinth, they do not believe because their minds have been kept in the dark by the evil god of this world. Folks, I want to say that sometimes that is us. That we block out the light that God would want to shine in our hearts. That sometimes we choose to ignore the God that wants to love us so much. And then if we read on the next part, and you can see that we can apply it to ourselves, he keeps them from seeing the light shining on them, the light that comes from the good news about the glory of Christ, that we can block that light. Now, Belinda is a person, I should stop there for those that don't know, Belinda's my wife, right? Belinda's a person who sleeps fairly lightly and always has a few struggles when there's a full moon, because she says it keeps her awake. And my answer is always, it's easy, you close your eyes, which she doesn't like very much, right? But it is that similar kind of idea that we can close our eyes, we can close our minds to the presence of God around us whenever we choose. And part of the challenge is to continuing to keep ourselves awake to the presence of God in our lives. So when we read these kind of ideas, don't always immediately go to the point where the reference might perhaps be to some external influence on our lives. Sometimes we are our own worst enemy, as the saying goes. Sometimes we choose to block out the light of Christ that can shine into our lives. And as we think about this idea, and Daryl mentioned Transfiguration Sunday, and this is the title that's given to the scripture that we read today, the Transfiguration of Jesus, where Jesus' image is changed, his image is changed. Because they see him on the mountain and he starts to glow in this incredible way. And it's a remarkable experience. But just we need to stop for a moment, because the reading began with 6 days later. So this event takes 6 days later. So what happens those 6 days before? Well, there's at least two key things that take place in the preceding stories. The first is that Jesus heals a person who's been blind. This is the fairly gross little story where Jesus spits on his hand and makes mud with the saliva. Do you remember this one? And he puts it on the person's eyes or on their eyelids and says, "Can you see?" And he says, "I see people walking, but they look like tree trunks." Anyone here need to wear glasses or had cataracts done or anything like that? Are you familiar with that idea? You know, you can see, but not clearly. And so Jesus repeats the process. What about now? And the person can see quite clearly. So this too sits with the sort of things we're talking about now, that the disciples had been journeying along with Jesus, seeing him, but perhaps not recognizing or understanding completely. And what happens on the mountain in the moment of transfiguration is they finally see more clearly. And the other story that that links to is where Jesus asks his followers, "Who do people say that I am?" And they say one of the people that they think he might be is Elijah come back. But then he follows that with the question, "Who do you say I am?" And that's where Peter declares Jesus as Lord, the Son of God. So once again, when we link these to this transfiguration story, we see that clarity coming. Here is Moses and Elijah seen on the mountain by these three men alongside Jesus. No, not them, but different to them. And certainly many would regard this story, particularly in Mark, but in each of the Gospels, as quite pivotal in the journey of Jesus. Up till now, people have been introduced to Jesus. Jesus is performing miracles. He's declaring who he is. People are starting to discover who this Jesus is, although he keeps telling them to be quiet. Have you noticed that? In the readings over the last few weeks, he'll do something remarkable and then he'll say, "But don't tell anyone." People who explore these things talk about that as the messianic secret. And we never quite work out why Jesus tells them to be quiet, unless it's a little bit like those times where perhaps you know that someone is going to tell someone else when you say to them, "Don't tell anyone, but..." So maybe that was part of the psychology of it, I don't quite know, but I choose to believe that Jesus at that point wasn't choosing to be fully known. But certainly after this point he is. Because from this point on, Jesus, the language that we use, we talk about Jesus turning his face toward Jerusalem. He's heading for the cross. And certainly in Mark's gospel, this story takes place almost right in the middle. This is the very beginning of chapter 9. Mark's gospel is only 16 chapters long. So it's almost right in the center of Mark's story about who Jesus is. And from this point on, Jesus turns his face towards Jerusalem, knowing, as he says to his disciples, he has told them just before this story, that he'll go to Jerusalem and that he will be executed for the sake of many. And so in the back half of Mark's gospel, from here on, Mark is actually preparing his disciples to take over his ministry and his work. So we have this remarkable moment as we conclude this time in our year, about to start our time of Lent, that period of 6 weeks or so prior to our Easter celebrations. So this is pivotal for us too, for it to come now, because we are also preparing ourselves for what happens in the Easter story, Palm Sunday, Good Friday, Resurrection Day. We're preparing ourselves for that too. And often you might be familiar that there this idea with this idea of giving something up for Lent. Who's heard that idea before? A number of you have heard that idea. And the idea of doing that is to connect ourselves quite deliberately through that period of preparation with the idea that Jesus gives all of himself for us. So this idea of giving something up. And Lynn Jackson showed me some work she was doing on a different idea through Lent. Are you still working on that, Lynn? Which is, I think, a cracking idea, because you might have heard Lynn share a couple of weeks ago about going up to share in an event on a Saturday that looked at about faith and caring for the creation and all that kind of idea. So she's come up with the idea of a carbon fast through Lent. So this is... And it happens at lots of different levels, really basic ones or more confronting ones if you want to take them on. But the idea of thinking about how we care for the planet through that time, and it might involve perhaps not using as much energy or thinking differently about recycling or whatever it might be. So some of those resources will be available from next week for you to be able to pick up for the first week in Lent. And I want to tell you, I'm going to have a go at that. So I'm going to be doing it. Might be an interesting thing for you to chat about after worship each week if you've been having a go. It's not a have-to thing, just something to think about. You'll note that in the past I've given up chocolate bars for Lent. That's tough, hey. Fried food 1 year, that was hard. I like my fish and chips. Do you like your fish and chips? So any number of things. But the idea then is that each time you think, oh, I'd like to, no, I better not. It's not just about losing weight or thinking differently about how we eat or even about how we use power. But each time we think about that thing or we don't do that thing, we stop and we remember the sacrifice that Jesus made for us. Does that make sense? So that's where that idea comes from and how that works. But in this story, we have the remarkable moment where the three disciples that have gone up the mountain with Jesus suddenly understand who he is. Moses and Elijah stand as two giants of the pre-Jesus story, what we call the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures, if you like. These two remarkable figures, Moses, the one who led the people from captivity to freedom, from being homeless to then living in the promised land. Elijah, one of the great ones of faith, who ascends into God's presence alive, lifted up in a fiery chariot, if you remember the story. Now, Jesus is seen by his followers often as an equal, standing amongst the others in the presence of Elijah and Moses, is often the way that story is interpreted. I'll share another reflection on that a little later. Elijah remained faithful in the midst of incredible opposition. He continued to speak the truth of God, even against the incredibly powerful people of his time, who actually looked to hunt him down and rid their world of him. But he spoke out against false gods and stood against the prophets of Baal, you might remember, and was also willing to name the king's wickedness before the people. It's not unreasonable then to assume that when Jesus asks the disciples, as I said before, who do people say I am, that Elijah might be one. In all of these things, we continue to see that Jesus is being revealed, that he's becoming known and understood by the people around him. And we hear this remarkable comment, or the three in the story hear that remarkable comment, "This is my own dear son. Listen to him." And the reflection that I wanted to offer you is one that I've only come across this last week, so I'm still wrestling with it a bit myself, but it makes sense. And that is that perhaps God is saying something slightly different here. We've said that in this story, Jesus turns his face towards Jerusalem, knowing that as people strive to or use the Mosaic law, Moses' law, to convict him, that that's likely to cost him his life. And so if we go back to this image of the transfiguration of Jesus on the mountain, we see Moses and Elijah and Jesus glowing in this remarkable way, and God says, "Listen to him." Hear the law from the past. Hear and understand the way the people of your time are interpreting that law. But listen to him. Above and beyond all those things that we might see, know and understand, we're being encouraged to listen to Jesus and his direction for us. So Nathan Nettleton puts it this way: "As I thought about this story, my thinking has been captured by the possibility that I never saw before. In the story, when the three disciples see Jesus transfigured on the mountain, they see Moses and Elijah standing there and talking to him. Usually we've interpreted this as a favourable comparison. Jesus stands in the same line as those two and brings fulfilment to everything they stood for. And given how significant Moses and Elijah were for the Jewish understanding of God and God's ways and God's working, perhaps such a comparison would be quite likely. But rather than being compared with Moses and Elijah, when God says, 'This is my own dear son, listen to him,' perhaps Jesus is being offered in contrast to them. The disciples are being called to choose between the law that they understand and how it's being applied, the popular mindset of their day, and the Jesus who has just told them that he's on his way to Jerusalem. Folks, we need to remember that as we look into the heart of Christ, that God calls us beyond the way we've been taught to understand things before. That sometimes there are new things to be revealed to us, remembering that Jesus comes not to replace but to fulfill all that's contained in the old covenant, in Moses' law, if you like. But then to bring it into the incredible light of God for our world. Because the aim is for us as well to be transfigured by the action of Jesus in our lives, for us also to be transformed. So that means that the idea that sometimes when we say, oh, you'll just have to put up with it, it's just the way I am, actually denies the idea that Jesus might be able to transform us. It applies to us individually, it applies to us corporately, it applies to us in all sorts of ways, but the first call in our lives, as God instructs in this reading, is to listen to the heart and mind, the will of Christ for us as his people. Last week we shared the covenant liturgy and the covenant prayer, where it talked about laying ourselves aside. Do you remember those words? Incredibly powerful. To lay ourselves aside so that God's will might be done and not ours. Rank us with whom you will, put us to what you will, and allow the will of Christ to dominate and lead our lives. Perhaps we too will have our own little transfiguration moment where we see and understand Jesus even more clearly. Amen.